Lowe's knows tough jobs call for tougher tools. The new DeWalt Elite Series Power Tool Accessories are built to last for the pro who doesn't stop. With precision fitment, durability, and impact resistance, finishing jobs faster has never been easier. Shop the new DeWalt Elite Series at an everyday low price exclusively at Lowe's. We help, you save.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is author, researcher, and polling maestro, Stanley Greenberg. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the link to our sponsor, Lomi, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. Hey, James, we have the perfect guest 5 days before the November 8 election, Dr. Stanley Greenberg, a polling mastermind. We're going to make this more of a conversation, James, so jump in anytime. Stan, let me just start. The New York Times yesterday had a headline, the off lead, left-hand side, that said that there was already second-guessing before the election among Democrats and that they stumbled on their message this fall. You agree?
Well, they more than stumbled. I can't use the word. but it also doesn't kind of capture the scale of what's going on, both the scale, you know, this election and the forces at work, you know, or the work that the Democrats need to do to get back in the game.
Well, you laid out that what they should do about almost 2 weeks ago, focus hard on the economy and the cost of living, contrast to empty Republican rhetoric, go hard on corporate greed and monopolies, and then know that abortion will be a complementary issue. But they didn't really do that, did they? The first part.
It's almost like they were. It's almost like there's like no national voice. Now, look, I listened closely to President Obama, who I love, and is one of those popular people we have. In the past, he's kind of looked pretty contented with the state of the country, in a country that wants big change. But, and he also brought out the other side, motivated the other side. But this time I heard him talking about them going after Social Security and supporting big money. And it was there was a much more engaged Obama. But it was different in each, it was different in each town. It was different from the White House. It was different from the Congress. There was no intense, unified. Republicans are so focused on winning. And the Democrats, I think, have keys for winning here, but just somehow don't invest, don't have that kind of battle to win.
James Wayne.
So Stanley, some weeks ago, you did a poll and you concluded that the Democrats shouldn't talk about crime. Mm-hmm. How bad is the crime issue hurting us right now?
It's the dominant issue. It is like half their advertising online in September. It is Fox News, with more and more, about crime. They are very focused, on crime. And look, when we ask a question that says, what's your, greatest worry about Democrats having control of the government? It just goes off the chart. That they'll in the Democratic cities, they'll be homeless, there'll be crime, there'll be attacks on police, and they've gotten it focused on them, on crime. But look, the problem is, we have always believed Democrats, our parties, our leaders have to fix the problems that people have about them, the doubts that they have about them, they have to reassure as a starting point. But the Democrat position on crime is so lost. That when we test the messages, when I test a bad message, by the way, when I test what Democrats are saying, I put all together from studying their campaigns and what they're saying, it's rejected by 10 points. And it then loses support. Then I tested a message I know works, which focuses on the police. The Democrats are people who believe are for defunding the police. They think that's our position. Democrats think that's our position. And so you have to reassure our police. Your message has to be totally about police, respecting the police, and not defunding the police, having more police. And that message was received very well. But it also lost its support because the more people focus on the crime as the issue, the more we're hurt. You know, we've had 2 years and longer of us getting this wrong and being, just not focusing on the priorities of the communities that we represent.
So you have been involved in Democratic politics, frankly, longer than I have, but let's just put it at a long time. Your wife is a very prominent Democratic member of Congress. People like you and I have long advocated for, while Biden did, but we never made a windfall profit tax on all companies, very central to what we were doing. We didn't make crime central to what we are, even though our voters and everyone was experiencing it at the same time. Why can't this party do that? Why when you go and you say it, they just humor you and say, we'll try that or anything. Why we couldn't have the discipline, to come down after Kevin McCarthy says he will shut the government down to force cuts in Social Security and Medicare. I can't imagine. Can you imagine anything in Poland more unpopular than that proposal?
Right. Look, there's two things. One is, can we win this election despite the crime problem, despite the border problem? And I think we could have been in a better position. This is a period since Trump of very high turnout, very polarized, parties. We have 15%, that have moved as Democrats to become Republicans under Trump, and the same have left the Republican Party to become Democrats. So we have like a kind of a restructuring of the party. There really are Cheney conservatives. I mean, this is a high turnout period, highly polarized, and we compete to have energy and consolidation. Democrats could have made further ground if they had focused on the cost of living as the main problem, the highest priority they have to address, particularly because Democrats had done things the same. They've done things. Republicans have done, nothing and voted against everything they're for. And on your point, we are asking the rich to pay, big corporation to pay tax, and it could not be more popular with the voters. So it was a way with the right message to kind of build the consolidation, of the voters that people heard. Like, people are hurting. So if they really heard us on the cost of living and felt we really understood that, felt that, we could have been heard. Instead, we have these messages all over the place, and then you just have crime and borders then taking over.
Stan, let me suggest at least, the Dobbs decision was a gift for Democrats, and then the Kansas vote. But I think, however, a number of candidates began to think this was a one-trick pony. It was a guaranteed way to victory. And they focused too much on that and not enough on the bread and butter issues you talk about. And look, without abortion, it might be a real red wave. But by itself, abortion wasn't enough.
No. And it was not going to be enough. And there are big issues facing the country. Abortion was never going to be enough to drive it. But also, we're in a global period of pandemic, hyperinflation in every country. Every country has a spiking inflation. This is a very unique period where people are being really hurt. Now, they had 2 decades of declining wages, and so they're really being hurt. And we gave them the slightest help, the household payments that happened during the pandemic, the child tax credit, improved healthcare costs or help with drug costs. They really knew it and were ready to vote for it. And this is a period of hyper inflation. So people, top of mind, we can move them on those issues. Every country in the world, the leaders are debating how to best deal with this cost of living crisis. Democrats were all over the board on it. it's hard for me to understand. I mean, the president, the White House, tried for 4 months to convince people that the economy is doing well. You know, like 70% of the people rate the economy negatively. We have our main message for months and months was to try to convince you the economy is better than you.
Right. To convince you what you feel isn't right, right? Yeah, right. To say to that voter, you're just dead wrong about what you think. We want to tell you that. And instead, I think in reading what you've done, if they had focused instead, all right, let's take inflation. Let's take prescription drug prices. Here's what we did. Let's take a cap on insulin. Let's go after the oil companies. And contrast that through. Very few candidates did that. Maybe a couple did, but not very many.
Yeah. I think the candidates themselves understood this, you know, and used it in their own advertising, that they're helping people with the costs. I mean, I think a lot of candidates used it. And
do you?
But abortion was a much bigger piece. If you look at the share of ads that were on it, they thought abortion was a stronger position. And look, voters had to hear first that the cost of living was your main focus. They're getting killed by it, but they don't favor the Republicans. We're kind of evenly split on which party's better on the cost of living, and far and away it's the top problem in the country. A majority chooses it as the main problem, but the question is, why aren't Democrats able to talk about the discontent? Well, there's two parts of this: the economic discontent, but also crime. I mean, what's going on in the community? They aren't seeing their own voters.
So you use the term cost of living instead of inflation. Is that intentional?
And I break it out. I mean, I have unemployment, I have the economy, and have cost of living, as separate items. Now, I started doing this in Britain. I mean, we had a local election. In Britain, where the cost of living was the main issue, and I began to realize, if you look in Europe, where you have even higher inflation, it's just a battle on who's gonna provide most help. Doesn't matter on ideology. The Tories, conservatives in Britain, were subsidizing energy bills and giving big grants to people to cover energy bills. Didn't matter. That's the real battle out there. So I changed my question in Britain, and I changed my question here. And it's, if you look at the top of the list, because that's what's real for people. It's what does it cost for them to live?
So some time ago, you did a poll on, I want to call it academic or left-wing language. And like defund the police, the Latinx. Could you let's go back and revisit that finding as we go into this election?
All right. So my philosophy is, I ask people what they want to be called. I knew Latinx, but I was even skeptical of Latino. And so among Hispanics, they use Hispanics. Latino is a very small percentage who use it. AAPI. What percentage of them you think are Pacific Islanders? I asked them what they call themselves, and they said Asian American was the big. And when I asked blacks, it's actually split with African American and black. African American now a little bigger, and so I kind of mix it up in terms of what people call themselves. But it comes with respecting them and respecting what they. What's going on in their lives. And I think what happened over the last, since the 2020 election, we had a very tumultuous year in 2020, as well as, George Floyd, the protests, a president who tried to drive up racial conflict. We had a pandemic, deep recession. All these things came together in 2020. And many elites decided to focus, only on addressing racial inequalities and racial justice, and not addressing all the other issues. And if you look at the data, That's not what these voters, our base voters, our working class, African-American, Hispanic voters, not what those voters say are the most, are the biggest problem. Not surprisingly, they say it's the economy. Not surprisingly, they want crime addressed. But the elite view decided a couple years ago that that shouldn't be the priority. And the and so I've been building and building, and I've actually written a piece, which I think will come out this week in the American Prospect, in which I call out that elite imposing that elite view of the world.
How did, because you're an elite academic, I went to Harvard and got a PhD from Yale, I can't remember which one, and you've taught. How does the party, in the leadership of the party, how do they fall for this kind of stupidity? Did somebody say, look, wait, come on, people, this, we can't do this? And they just sort of go along with it. I don't know.
You'll see in this article, and I put together a multi-generational, multi-racial team of pollsters, and where each one asked questions, on the priorities in each community. And what you'll see is when you take pieces like path to citizenship, or hate crimes, against Asian Americans, was always at the middle or bottom of the list of things that they were, focused on. But this got imposed as the number one priority for the administration. If you listen to the Biden administration, it says that's its, priority. And so, look, this has been, this is driven at a high level. It's a big part of the Democratic agenda. But fortunately, the voters, our own voters, are not where they are.
So we're not even talking to the base, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Not only does it offend swing voters in Ohio, whatever mythology we have, it actually offends black people in Georgia.
Most of all.
In our
question for blacks, crime was right up with cost of living, almost the same as a top priority.
It's just so stunning that an educated political party can embrace stupidity on this level.
No, it really is. Let me digress for a second, Stan, and say the other thing that I think unfortunately doesn't matter is truth and character. I think we saw it this week in the reaction of many Republicans to the brutal beating of Speaker Nancy Pelosi's husband, Paul, by a right-winger. And there were a lot of jokes by Republicans about a man who just undergone surgery or, in keeping with earlier lies, spun a conspiracy. I'm going to do something I really do. I'm going to praise Mitch McConnell. He was an exception. He really reacted with horror and expressed support and empathy for the family. You don't expect Donald Trump to do that because he's a stranger to truth and incapable of any human emotion. His son Donnie is a pale carbon. But look across the board. The Arizona gubernatorial candidate, Carrie Lake, Trump in a skirt, made a joke about a man being operated on for a skull fracture. House members like Claudia Tenney and Clay Higgins, James can tell us about Clay Higgins from Louisiana, spun a malicious lie, but it doesn't matter.
Look, I'm worried. We have an election, that's edging toward the Republicans, winning the House. And I think the Senate will be close on who has control. But I worry that they view that as a mandate, that they did all this and were able to take over, certainly the House, and maybe more. And they will feel justified in that. And that pains me that our own voters, look, I'm angry at us. We have two big shifts in this poll that we just did. One is moderate Democrats, who moved significantly by 10 points to the Republicans, is on crime and border. And we also have Hispanics, men, where we break even, and that's a result of us not speaking on the economy. But both of those are outrageous because our being captured by an elite agenda means we don't see our own working class-based voters, and therefore they're allowing the Republicans to win. They're not winning because in the Republican space, they're winning in our space.
So let's project forward. Hope if this election turns out not very bad, and people will come, will say, let's talk about the elite wing of the party, the left wing of the party, and it, you say it's driving off moderate Democrats by more than just a T90 bid. It's driving off Hispanic males, all right? Should some kind of evaluation be done to say, are these people really, it is assumed that they bring energy and fundraising and online presence and everything. Well, you think the Democrats need to look and say, are these people really worth it? Do they bring in more? Do they bring more people in, or do they cause more people to leave? I mean, it's just a question we need to ask.
Well, for sure, they drive voters out, and they drive away our own voters. But I think this is going to have to be fought out in the primary. I mean, I think as we know, with Bill Clinton, we fought against the Jackson, the Jackson wing of the party, and we had to call out that wing of the party in order to get hurt. And I think it's so bad, to be honest, on crime, that it will be hard. Look, 95% of Democrats vote for increased funding for for police, vote for ICE, vote for increasing the number of first responders, more funding for locals to have police. Our party is for law enforcement, stronger law enforcement, more police. I think Biden proposed 100,000 more police. We're a more police party. And the only way they'll get heard on this, I believe, is tell them we're not the party of that small group that, will vote against, all appropriations, all bills that do any funding for police.
Stan, how many voters do you think realize that Joe Biden has called for 100,000 more police?
None. us on this call.
I mean, boy, that says a lot.
Yeah, and you'll see in his poll that it's I'll be in this article this week that's the most popular thing that we can say, because it says it just pushes back with a giant pushback against the idea that we want to defund the police.
So let's talk a little bit. But we're talking a lot about American politics, and we should. But the subject is near and dear to both of our hearts is Israeli politics. What are your sort of observations post this last vote?
Well, there's still some chance of, one or two smaller parties reaching threshold. And that would dramatically affect, whether Netanyahu can form the government. I don't want to get fully ahead of ourselves, but it would be a, it's dependent on parties that are anti-Arab, violent in their views of Arabs, Orthodox Haredi parties as well. It would be a very right-wing government. To be honest, that will struggle to deal with the U.S. government on a whole range of issues.
But there's some chance that Bibi will not be able to put together a coalition.
Yeah, there's two or three parties that are right at the within a half a point of being on threshold. That changes it dramatically. Merit is not the moment on threshold.
Well, Stan, also if Bibi does form a government, it's going to be a nightmare for Biden, because Bibi is a Trump guy and he's not going to do anything to help Joe Biden or the Democrats.
Absolutely. And you have the Congress as well, in which it will be, if you have a leading people who are associated with the Hamas, movements, in Israel, terrorist groups in Israel, it's a different place. But they're also going after the Constitution, rule of law, judiciary. There's a lot at stake.
So there's been a lot of talk, appropriately so, on the politics of the UK. There's probably no American that has been more involved in UK politics than you. What's the current state of play there? tell us where we're going.
Look, country's a mess. Brexit has turned out to, kind of dramatically, lower their imports and investments. They have slower growth, higher inflation, and they have that for the foreseeable future. And they do need a growth strategy, and labor is, also talking about that as well, and they're seen as credible. They can stay in power, for 2 years, and they don't dare, because right now the Conservatives would get wiped out, if there were an election. So they can push this for 2 years, but they have like 2 years of austerity, 2 years of trying to find the funds, to fund people dealing with cost of living, energy costs. And so they're at a crisis on top of crisis, loss of confidence. But it's the Conservatives in deep trouble as a party, and they're fractured, divided party.
Stan, we had a conversation with Ed Luce last week, of the Financial Times, ended up talking about, what had the worst political process or system, Great Britain or the United States. It was kind of a tough call. I would add Israel to that. For a country as admirable and with such able people, they have such a screwed up system.
we have great democracies that are, well, and our problem is, in all these countries, we have large blocks of voters, maybe a majority. But usually, in the 45% range, large blocks of voters that are at this point become nationalist and anti-democratic. As we've seen in Brazil, as we've seen in France, seen in Italy, where they're obviously, even bigger than that. And so we have election systems, but we have polarization with large blocks that are anti-democratic and not necessarily accepting election outcomes, or certainly not accepting constitution. Which is what happened in Israel.
Yeah.
And what was happening with Johnson and Britain.
Well, James, you may have a final question, but I just want to say, Stan Greenberg, you've been a great guest. We've covered the global landscape, and whatever happens next Tuesday, I just hope Democrats will read your piece and start taking it to heart.
Thank you so much. It was everything I hope for and more, and I think our audience really enjoys this. But the aftermath of this is going to cause some hand wringing. But parties, political parties have to go through this.
It's already begun.
We need it.
Stan Greenberg, thank you so much. Be safe.
You bet.
Hey, now for our listener questions, and boy, do we have a lot of good ones this week. Let's start off with Fred in Bedford Hills, New York, who asks, am I right to blame the progressive takeover of the Nevada State Democratic Party from the Harry Reid centrist as a reason the Republicans might win that Senate seat? James, you have been in Nevada.
I am in
give
Nevada.
Give us the on-site analysis.
Sure. Right. Well, I had a long conversation with John Ralston, who is the... by far the most informed commentator.
And a former guest of ours.
Former guest of our show. I think multiple times. But at any rate, so Harry Reid built, by any estimation, the most successful state party in the country. It were two female Democratic United States senators. It was the first majority female state legislature was Nevada, most all of it because people that Harry Reid recruited. There's nobody that was better at promoting women or people of color or different aspects than Nevada was. And so our progressive DSA geniuses say, I'll tell you what to do. Let's just take over the best state party in the United States. And, of course, what's happened is that these campaigns just circumvent the state party. Now, it used to be a real valuable part and a real tool. And I think that they feel like they've gotten a alternative organization that is actually quite good. But I think we have to ask ourselves, do the DSA people do they really want Democrats to win? And I think there's a case to be made that they don't. They would like to be on the outside telling each other how they're morally superior to these compromising, power-grubbing Democrats who won't be as pure and smart and as righteous as we are. And that's a perfect example. It was a great question from our friend from New York.
Yeah, sure is. And the DSA, James, the Democratic Socialist of America, they're the ones right. that took it over.
They never run against Republicans. They only run against Democrats. That's their whole deal.
You know, the next question, I'm really going to combine two. One is Cody in Nashville, Tennessee, and Gordon in, actually three, Gordon in Norwood, Michigan, who asked, what the hell is going on with members of the Progressive Caucus undercutting Biden's Ukraine policy 2 weeks before the midterm, especially Jamie Raskin? And let's combine that with Wesley in Raynham, Massachusetts, who said, if Trump were still president, would he send troops and supplies to help the Russians? You know, Kevin McCarthy's threat to cut off aid to Ukraine is one more example of Republican support for totalitarian dictators. Both are absolutely right, and I want to start off with Cody and Gordon. We talked about this a little bit last week. What that Progressive Caucus did is beyond malpractice. It's outrageous. And it wasn't just releasing it, they say, accidentally. They blamed it on the staff 2 weeks beforehand. It was writing the stupid letter in the first place. Whatever they say, I think we fought a number of wars that weren't in our long-term interest, in Iraq and in Afghanistan after the initial foray. I think this is in our interest. This is the front line of the battle for freedom. The Russians invaded, and I think to undercut the president at this time was insane. And I do think, I mean, you got to understand, this Republican Party has a lot of pro-Russian members. And I think Kevin McCarthy's threat to cut off aid or reduce the kind of support Ukraine needs is one more dangerous move that would happen if he's Speaker of the House, and it would illustrate Republican support, as you say, Wesley, for totalitarian dictators.
Well, this thing is so stupid, it got me to thinking. I don't know. You know how they have these artificial intelligence things, that they have these programs that we can beat the best chess player in the world? Maybe the progressives have a random stupid idea generator that they put a lot of stuff in the data and say, let's see what the stupidest thing that we can do today. Well, okay, this might be the most successful foreign policy initiative since World War II. I mean, we've unified Western Europe, Sweden and Finland have come into NATO. Russia illegally and criminally invaded a sovereign nation, engaged in genocide. They had boxes of teeth where they were pulling the teeth out of these people. And my favorite is the Congresswoman Jacobs, who said, well, in politics, timing is everything. I wouldn't sign it today, but I signed it in June. Well, what you didn't know about Putin in June that you know today? You didn't know he was a criminal? You didn't know he was an international thug? You didn't know he had conducted an illegal invasion? You didn't know he was torturing people? You didn't know he was dragging people off the streets? You didn't know all of this? And then they blame it on a staffer. Oh, my God. This thing is so monumentally dumb that I can't. Of course, they don't have an answer because there is no answer. The answer is artificial intelligence came up with this and they went along with it because they're not smart enough to think of something this stupid. They're really, in case you don't know, I really am not a fan of this letter.
I think we know now, and I agree with you. And the justification is some as well. We ultimately have to have a negotiated settlement to this war. We may. Who knows? But don't undercut the good guys while you're doing that, which is exactly what this letter and Kevin McCarthy, they are, and on this issue, they're in bed with Kevin McCarthy, which is an uncomfortable place.
Okay, it's just such a stupid thing. What did aura did Putin put off that he would be in any way, shape, or form amenable? And by the way, by you writing this letter, let me tell you exactly what you did. You demonstrate that to Putin, that I don't need to call for a negotiated settlement because they're going to call for one before. And the West is going to weaken.
Right.
And we're going to be triumphant. And these people are playing right into Vladimir Putin's hand. Again, this is so monumentally stupid that it's hard to get to comprehend. And then the lame justification. Of course, we had a negotiated settlement with Japan. You lost. We had a negotiated settlement with Germany. You lost. All right? You cannot deal with people like Tojo and Hitler and these kinds of people, and Putin, by being nice to them. That does not work.
Yeah.
You ought to go back to your elite college you went to and restudy history.
Well, it does play right into Putin's hand, because his view is that we can outweigh him. The West will wilt. And he just got some encouragement from that Progressive Caucus letter and from Kevin McCarthy.
He certainly did.
Eileen in South Windsor, Connecticut. James, I want you to take this one. There's a theory out there that if Democrats don't take the House, don't keep the House, it will force a reset with the Democratic Party. My thought is if the Republicans take the House and their chaos caucus creates such noise in this country, it could benefit us in 2024. What do you think?
I think these are all valid points. All right. And I hope I'm like anybody else. I really hope for the best come election day, but you have to be prepared that it may not turn out very well. We have to wait till this is over. And I think the party's gonna have to take a long look at itself. I think more than anything, we're going to need we're waiting to see what President Biden says, but right now, we just appear to the public to not be in charge, that there's too much disorder in the country, that too many people in the Democratic Party that defended disorder, which never, ever, ever works. And hold off on repercussions and everything else, and let's see what happens. But what I'm seeing now is not that impressive. And of course, the main thing is the progressive people blocked any talk of the Democrats running on the crime issue. And so, I'm going to make this point very clear. The record on crime is very, very favorable to Democrats. I mean, the Biden-Clinton crime bill from 93 to 2019 saw people couldn't explain the drop in the crime rate. I mean, maybe it wasn't that. About it was some the sentencing stuff, which they actually put in for John Kasich, if you want to be really accurate with the history, was unduly harsh. But that was you were faced with the totality of the bill. In the last year of the Trump administration, crime spiked. Well, we should have jumped all over that. And their answer is so ridiculous. Well, it's in Democrat cities. First of all, it's higher in Republican-run centers. See the murder rate in Bakersfield and Jacksonville, two Republican cities, versus San Francisco, all right, which is a Democratic-run city. I mean, 8 of the 10 states with the largest increase in crime are run by Republican governors, have Republican gun laws in place and everything else. I think that we will pay for this stupidity. We're paying for it now, and I fear that we're going to pay for it in the future. And it's an issue that we have a much better record than they do, but we're scared to say it. Go figure.
Yeah.
Go figure.
Yeah, they seeded the issue in many places, and when you seed the issue and people care about it, it comes back to haunt you, and it has, I'm afraid. Marie in Portland, Oregon says, why don't we as a country and corporations acknowledge that we need migrant labor? We need South American immigrants. First of all, Marie, you're absolutely right. Canada just has put out a request for, I think, 1.25 million immigrants. They need them to fill important jobs there. We need them, too. I want to see what Ron DeSantis does about cleaning up that disaster in Florida without migrants. First of all, I think Democrats need to say we need to secure the border. That's just a sine qua non of an immigration policy. And when Kamala Harris said the border is secure, people don't believe that. And once you say that, I then think you can advocate strongly for a more liberal immigration policy. We need those workers, and hopefully push for some kind of immigration legislation. We came close 15 years ago with George W. Bush and Ted Kennedy and John McCain. You shouldn't give up on that. Immigration is popular in America. What's unpopular is a porous border.
Yeah. So, look at the problems that we have. The labor shortage is real. People see that every day. All right? Well, how do you address the labor shortage? You have more laborers. How do you get more laborers? You have more immigration. Don't even get started on Southwest Florida and Ron DeSantis. As you know, I still predict that when I drive from New Orleans to Destin, when I enter Florida, as Governor Ron DeSantis welcomes you to Florida, a sanctuary state. They are so desperate. But immigrant labor in Southwest Florida, it's starting to dawn on people just what a nightmare they're facing. First of all, they're going to try to collect insurance. Well, lots of luck with that, and lots of luck at which you get, because these insurance companies are notoriously for fighting claims, and you're going to have all kind of arguments with them about what's wind damage, what's water damage, what's anything else. The second thing, of course, inflation is high. It's high everywhere in the world, I would point out. So when you go to rebuild, assume that you get any insurance money. So you go to rebuild. Well, you're going to have increased costs of these materials. You're not going to be able to find everybody, because a lot of other people are going to be rebuilding at the same time. And the sticker shock that you're going to get when you see the cost of replacement on a barrier island, where when I looked at the photos, they had houses built on a slab. This is really dumb. And a lot of people are not going to be able to return. It's going to be prohibitive, because they're going to have to be built on stilts. They're going to have to be built high above sea level. And that just adds to the expense. So I really feel for the people of Southwest Florida. I have a pretty good idea what's coming, and what's coming for them is not very pretty.
Well, yeah, and Marie, I just want to add one other point. We have a demographic issue here. There are with a birth rate, there are fewer younger people coming in to support elderly people, and that's where immigrants help. They, first of all, are productive. Secondly, they commit crimes at a far lower rate. And so I think America is not only going to have a labor problem in ensuing years, but we'll end up having a Social Security problem too if we don't bring in productive workers. Again, the border.
Have you looked at the Army recruiting numbers?
Yeah.
They're terrible.
Yep.
They're worried. You know who serves in the military? Of course, you know who serves in the military. Disproportionately high numbers. Yes.
A lot of them are DACA kids.
And you know, it's having a terrible. You know, one of the things that we need to talk about after the election is China. Because, 2-3 years ago, China was a classic example of a rise in power. Now they might be the classic example of a decline in power. And it might be they're even more dangerous as a decline in power. They have enormous demographic challenges. I mean, enormous. They're stopping reporting economic numbers.
The one-child policy was an it was the most disastrous move since Mao's sent them back to the farms.
Yes, but we need to do sometimes, and after the election, we're going to give it a couple of weeks, but we need to get some China experts on here, because I think there's things that are happening there that could really affect our lives, to say the least.
Oh, that's a good idea. We will do that. We have Kyle in Portland, Oregon. We got a lot of Portland listeners out there, James. Kyle says, I keep hearing Republicans will introduce articles of impeachment against Joe Biden, and I might add others, if they take back the House. They've already tried this year, but Nancy Pelosi won't let it go to committee. Why not let it go to committee? Heck, let's have a full House vote, knowing it won't pass. I'm thinking of President Clinton's approval numbers after impeachment.
Well, they don't impeach him. I don't have anything to impeach him for. But you know, McCarthy is not going to be able to control that caucus. And they've already told McCarthy that he's not going to be able to control him. I don't think he could control him if he wanted to. And this is just going to be part of the fabric. And the White House counsel is going to be the busiest man in the world. There'll be so many subpoenas in there. I think that there was, I don't know how many hours of sworn testimony on the Clinton Christmas card list. Well, you're going to see this like you can't believe it. And, you know, but against this backdrop, I'm just increasingly convinced, and I don't really have much pushback on this. I think Garland is going to indict Trump, and I think it's going to be sooner and not later. And, you know, what's going to be the reaction to that? The House Republicans, you name it, the country. But I don't know how he can't indict Trump. I mean, he stole something that doesn't belong to him. They politely asked him to give it back. He refused. Then they sent people down there, refused again. Then they sent him a subpoena. He lied. He still has the stuff. They went in and they found it. How can you not? Explain to me how you cannot indict this guy.
I can't explain that, James. And I think you're certainly right. I think he likely will. And I'll tell you what the reaction of House Republicans will be. They'll try to impeach Garland because that's what they're about. People, everyone out there, I want you to do some research. Look at Jim Jordan, who will be the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, you know, the lead role in all of this. Look at him in the Ohio State wrestling scandal where a physician was sexually assaulting wrestlers, six of whom and a referee and others have testified that assistant coach Jim Jordan knew about that. If this is true, that was a crime, what that doctor did, and covering up that crime is a crime. Take a look at the Ohio State wrestling scandal, athletic scandal, and Jim Jordan. That's a pet peeve of mine.
But it's a good one. Yeah. It should be.
It is. All right, this is an easy one. Isaac in Hampton, Virginia. Where is the best place to watch election coverage on election night? Well, obviously, it's the PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff. There's no question of that. Or if James Carville is going to be anywhere, you can quickly turn the channel and catch him and then go back to the PBS NewsHour with Judy Woodruff. She's my wife, by the way.
Yeah, I'm going to be on MSNBC. And Steve Kornacki is really good. I mean, that guy is, you know, his kind of magic board and stuff. But he's pretty quick on the uptake. The one thing on election night I would look for early is Virginia, too, because they count very early in Virginia. And, you know, if you lose that, that's not good.
Well, and Virginia 7, I think it's 7 with Spanberger, too.
Right, so Spanberger. You know, Maine, too, I think they report pretty early.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty competitive
Democrats
race,
so. Seem to be in pretty good shape in Maine, too, I've heard. But in any event, if Democrats lose, you know, two or three of those, it's going to be a long, long night. So, you know, I'll say one, you know, there are some people who are good on election night, but every election night I have a enhanced nostalgia for Tim Russert. Nobody could do elections like Timothy J. Russert. We have a question, a final question, I think, from Patrick in Exeter, New South Wales, Australia. And we love our Down Under listeners. Who asked, James, which voting bloc should we expect to surprise with their passion this election? The insane right or the moderate left?
I don't know.
I'll tell you what we hope, James. I'll just quickly add, what we hope is the surprise will be young voters. I'm afraid they won't be, but that's what we hope.
I do, and I hope you're right, but when I call around about the early vote, what I'm hearing is not great.
Well, in most places, it seems pretty good in Georgia. It doesn't seem as good in Ohio. So, you know, and there's several more days to go.
I think in Nevada is not great.
Yeah, yeah. So that doesn't.
The hope was it would see things that really affected them and they would come out, but I'm skeptical. Please prove me wrong.
If you don't vote next Tuesday, young people, don't complain about threats to your future, okay? It's that simple. Some of my favorite moments are with podcasts. One to start is Harvard professor Khalil Gibran Muhammad and journalist Ben Austin. Our friends, one's black, one's white. They grew up together on the south side of Chicago. As adults, Khalil and Ben are still best friends, but they know that interracial friendships aren't going to solve the problems of a deeply divided country. On their podcast, Some of My Best Friends Are, Khalil and Ben have real talks about the absurdity of race in America. They invite guests like Attorney General Eric Holder, restorative justice leader Daniel Sarid, and TikTok historian Sherman Dilla Thomas to join critical conversations that are at once personal, political, and playful. Hey, James, that's a pretty interesting show.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, people say, you know, we don't talk about race or we should talk about race. Well, these people are trying to provoke a conversation and they're worthy of support. It's something that we got to discuss and put out and open.
Hey, listen to Some of My Best Friends Are wherever you get podcasts and stay tuned for a preview right now.
My seventh grade yearbook listed me as Kahlua Muhammad.
Man, I am still mad at that. I am not Kahlua. I am Khalil Gibran Muhammad.
Man, I'm just plain old Ben Austin. We are two best friends.
One black.
One white.
I'm a historian.
And I'm a journalist.
And we are back for season two of Some of My Best Friends Are.
Well, y'all actually read the book. I appreciate that.
That's right. We are here. We have done all the reading.
All of it.
And we are ready.
I'm so happy I get to finally proclaim that I'm a nerd, right? I don't got to fake like I like football anymore for my friends and all that.
That's right. This season, we're continuing the conversation about the absurdities and intricacies of race in America.
Man, you came on the show just throwing haymakers. You're just like, you got it.
You started it. You brought up this question of violence. You gotta take that casually.
We know that interracial friendship isn't going to solve the problems of our deeply divided country. But we're ready to discuss what's possible and what needs fixing.
Join us as we talk to guests like restorative justice leader Danielle Sarid, former Attorney General Eric Holder.
Historians, nerds, TikTok stars.
Exactly. We're all trying to make sense of this moment we're in. And sometimes our guests become our friends.
And maybe even our best friends. They got to work hard for that.
Yes.
So stop by. New episodes drop weekly starting November 1st on iHeartMedia, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, and now for our outrage of the week. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts takes issue when anyone refers to this as a Republican court. It's the old we only call balls and strikes. Well, this week, the chief struck out in putting a hold on lower court decisions that the IRS, as the law requires, has to turn over Donald Trump's tax returns. It's been requested by the appropriate congressional committees. Following the law, a Trump-appointed judge said this issue was clear, as did the Court of Appeals, including a Republican. Roberts decided to overrule them, at least for now. You know, Trump first promised to release his tax returns to the public during the 2016 presidential campaign. Yet another lie, he never intended to. The Trump plan is to run the clock now for the next 2 months until Republicans take over the House, and then they would cancel veto the legitimate request for his tax returns. If this works and Trump gets away with cheating again, let's be clear, Chief Justice Roberts would be an enabler.
Well, there's no doubt about that. I take my outrage in a little bit of a different direction because I want to talk about a piece that John Chait wrote about an Eric Wimple column in the Washington Post, which goes through the saga of James Bennett being fired at the New York Times. And the reason that this is, of course, James Bennett was unjustly fired, as was Donald F. McNeil, but that battle has been fought and lost. But the entire reign of progressive terror that was taking place in the country at that time, and to some extent is still taking place, has really, really hurt the image of the party. It really has. and the you know, sacking people for the most ridiculous or convoluted or secondary offenses in the back of some progressive mind spills out into the greater public and does real damage. And one of the damaging things that happened, and I'll probably put myself in the center here, but that's all right. I urge the Democrats to take the crime issue seriously. And basically it was told that if we do that, we'll have a progressive uprising in the party. Well, okay, as opposed to having a progressive uprising in the party, in a lot of places it looks like we're having a voter uprising against us. Hey, I hope we do well. I hope people like Michael Moore are right. I hope that some of these current polls I'm seeing are not what they look like. But, you know, come Wednesday, a week from now, I think this party is going to have to take a serious look at itself and how does it go from here? And we cannot abandon an issue like crime. That's just ridiculous.
Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we would really appreciate it if you check out the link to our sponsor, Lomi, in the show notes. We thank you for supporting them. When you do, it helps make this podcast happen. To keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another. This will be a post-election show as we continue our war room planning.